So I've got a super special guest on the property podcast this week. I'm actually going to interview Rob D about his own property development exploits. He's got a lot to share here. Some stuff went right, but as you'd expect with property development, a lot went wrong.
Welcome to the Property Podcast, where every Thursday, property investors come to be informed and inspired. The learning today is coming from my experience. I've been involved for the last year and a half or so in a development project, which has recently come to an end. There's been some dark days, but there's been a lot of learnings to take away as well. So I'll be sharing all of those. And then in Hub Extra, if I've still got the strength, we'll be recommending a podcast that I've been listening to obsessively recently.
Rob, wouldn't it be lovely to know how much house prices are going to go up by the next 5 years?
Yeah, that'd be great. Could you make that happen?
Well, I can't, but the good folks at Savills can, Rob. They've produced a lovely report giving us the predicted price rises in England and Wales over the next 5 years. A lovely early Christmas present for us all.
So they have, and even better, it's in line with what we've been saying. Hooray! So they predict that the highest regional growth between 2019 and 2024 is going to be in the Northwest, which is going to go up by 24%, they reckon. And the lowest, do you want to have any guesses, Rob?
Oh, I might struggle with this one, Rob. Could it be London?
It could be London, yeah. Yeah. With just 4% growth over the next 5 years. And the reasons that they give for that, much as we've been saying, basically there's more room for growth. The recovery in the north has been slower. There's more, the affordability's better, etc., etc.
Yeah, and Yorkshire as well is the second highest performer according to their predictions. And that'll be increases of 21%. As we said, Rob, this is in line with our predictions. But I wouldn't be shocked if these numbers end up higher. I wouldn't be surprised at all. But it's really interesting to see the experts at Savills listen to the podcast that have copied all our predictions. Oh, or maybe not. Maybe it's their own independent thinking as well. Hopefully so, because that gives us even more confidence.
Just before we get into our main topic this week, a quick reminder that as well as the podcast, we are on YouTube as well. And last week we uploaded our essential guide to property tax. So if you're not sure about all the many and various taxes you have to pay and some of the ways that you can go around mitigating that, then make sure you check that video out. You can find a link in the show notes. You can also go over to YouTube, search Property Hub UK, and you'll find us right there.
So one of our most popular podcasts over the last 12 months is when we looked at the project we worked on at Grand Junction. And that was quite an eventful and emotional journey. And if you'd like to listen to that very painful episode, you can do by listening to episode 315. But incredibly, Rob D wasn't put off by that. He has had a project on the go just outside of York. So with any development project, there's lots that can be learned from it. And any development project of this size, where you're talking about multiple units, well, the lessons are all exaggerated. So this should be brilliant. Might not be for Rob D, but it will be for me and you listening, because we hopefully are going to learn a lot. So Rob, you ready to relive this yet? Has it been long enough?
No, it has not. I was having a really nice morning up till now. The sun shined. I was in a good mood. And now you're going to make me relive a year of pain. But okay, as long as people learn from it, I'm up for it.
Okay, let's start from where we probably should do, really, and tell everyone about the development.
Yeah, so the development was in a place called Moulton, which is about half an hour outside York. It's a commuter town for York, but it's also a lovely place to live in its own right. It's got lots of history, it's won awards, it's a beautiful little place. And we recognised it as an opportunity because there's been no new construction there at all. If you look on to rent, all there really is old conversions, which aren't particularly nice. No modern flats at all, and not much of anything being built in general. So as the area's been becoming more popular, there's just not been a lot of supply, and that means there's good sales potential for the owner-occupier market as well. So that's why we zeroed in on that location. The site that we found had an old social club on it, so that needed to be knocked down. In its place, we built a block of 9 flats, and then there's also a conversion element as well for a 10th flat. So that was the scheme.
So Rob, obviously, we're not meeting for the first time, but for the benefit of everyone listening, what was your prior experience before doing this? What experience did you have with development?
personally, not a lot to none. So I've done a few kind of refurb, refinance type things. I've been involved in one flip, but I was not hands-on during that process. So this was absolutely not something I would tackle on my own. Luckily, I had a partner, David, who I've worked with on several projects before. He's been doing this kind of thing for 30-odd years. So he was on site the whole time. He did all the costings, found all the trades, all that kind of thing.
Okay, so I assume you didn't have you down there at weekends labouring. So what was your involvement, Rob? What did you do?
What did I do? That is a good question. I was more involved on the finance side, doing some of the admin bits and pieces, and also looking after the sales, so making sure that they were all shifted by the time the project was finished. So if you're looking at division of labour, David did comfortably 95% of the work, but the amount of stress I experienced just from doing the 5%, I would not want any more responsibility than that.
Okay, so was it as much as a day-to-day level and things that you had to do? Was it week by week, or was it just do a bit ad hoc, like involvement wise how did it look like? Because obviously you've got a lot going on besides this development project, so on top of that as well, how did you fit it in?
Yeah, there were large stretches of time where there wasn't really a lot going on. So I made sure that things like invoices got paid. So that was just something that had to be done weekly. But the bulk of it on my side was setting it all up in the first place. So actually getting the land purchase through, helping out with all the permissions and things that you need at the start. Then when it came to the end, there was a lot of work that I'm sure we'll talk about later. Then in the middle, it was just bits of communication with solicitors and estate agents and things like that. So on my side, there was quite a lot of stress, but not a lot of time-consuming activity. For David, though, it was a full-time job for the best part of a year because he was looking after everything on site. So actually, the times when it was quietest for me, it was busiest for him because that's when the actual hard work of the build was going on.
So like you said, it is hard work and there's a lot to do, and a full-time job's a massive commitment. So did you consider outsourcing the project and letting a contractor just take control of the whole thing? Or was there a deliberate reason why you went down this route?
Well, because David is so experienced and he's done this kind of thing so many times before, it kind of seems silly not to use his skills. And I think when you know something inside out, it's quite difficult to give it over to someone else, and you don't know if they will do it at such a good cost. You don't know if they'd do it as well. We were originally planning to use a main contractor, not to do absolutely everything, but to basically supply all the trades to get the main structure built. And that should have saved a lot of effort of coordinating different trades. In fact, though, that contractor ended up pulling out before we actually started. Good thing it was before we started. So we ended up hiring in individual trades for every part of the job, which wasn't part of the original plan, but needed to be done.
So, Rob, how did it go? All smooth running? Easy? No hiccups?
Of course not, Rob. It's a development project. You know that that never happens.
Unfortunately, I do.
No, so in the end, it got built. Could say that. We got it done. It was about 6 to 8 months late in the end. And we didn't make any money from it.
So a typical development then?
So a typical development, yeah. So something was meant to take about a year end to end, ended up taking closer to two. And the profit that was supposed to be there just evaporated. But the positive from it is that it has sold really well and it's letting extremely well also. So the actual investment thesis was all correct. But as happens with developments, it didn't go as smoothly as we thought it would.
So Rob, I don't think there is a dream project. I've not heard of one yet. And as we touched on, things do go wrong. But can you break into a bit of detail of some of the things that did go wrong for you on site?
Yeah, for sure. So as I've already mentioned, the original contractor who we were going to use vanished. So in the end, we had to use individual trades. So that created a lot more work. Luckily, like I said, David is super experienced and he was brilliant throughout the whole thing. Nothing that went wrong was down to any issues on site, and his experience actually prevented a lot of issues that could have caused really serious problems. So without his experience, we would have really struggled. But all the things that caused us problems were more those random issues that can happen, and a lot of them being administrative. So as always happens when planning permission is granted for a project, it always comes with a number of pre-construction conditions, so certain things that you have to do before you can even start work. We bought the site with planning, so there were no delays in the actual planning, but getting all the conditions discharged took a really long time because there were a lot of them, and it's very easy for delays to creep in there. So a large part of the delay, probably a good half of the delay, if not more, was before we actually put a spade in the ground. Then we had a delay at the end because of utilities. Utilities, again, something that is really common to have issues with in developments. Rob, I know I don't need to tell you this. And that must have delayed us by about a month, just trying to get a date for them to come and do what they needed to do. It was even more difficult because we needed to coordinate water and electricity to happen at the same time because the council would only let us take up the road once. So trying to get two utility companies to turn up on the same day to do something. And then there were other things that didn't cause delays but just created a lot of stress. So the one that caused the most stress for me is before we started the project, we got an environmental report done showing that there were no concerns with the site, no contamination, nothing that could cause any issues getting mortgages in the future. All good. Then when we sold the first unit, one of the buyers went and had their own environmental survey done as part of the purchase, and it came back showing that there was some contamination on site. Now, it was just one of those random things, because when you get these surveys done, nobody actually turns up. It's all done by computer. It's based on historical data and all manner of other things. And so there's a bit of randomness in there. So it was basically a false positive. We knew this, but trying to convince the lenders of this and get that survey overturned was a whole other thing. In the end, we had to get someone to come out to site and actually do a proper survey where they take soil samples and all sorts, which took weeks and cost a load of money. And in the end, it turned out, as we'd known all along, it was fine. And during that time, it was really stressful, because if there were any contamination issues after all, then the site would be unmortgageable, basically, and we'd really struggle to sell them, and it would take a real hit to the value. So all fine in the end and a complete non-issue, but no fun at all while it was happening.
No, it's not fun, is it? It's like you were cursed, like you'd been building on some ancient burial ground or something, and like the spirits were angry with you. But obviously that didn't happen, did it, Rob?
Well, it's funny you should say that. but one of the conditions of planning was that we had to get an archaeological survey done. So after clearing the site, when digging for the foundations, we actually had to have someone from a local heritage society come along and watch us doing it to make sure that there was nothing there. What a silly and pointless exercise, you might have thought. But as it turned out, we did actually uncover a Roman burial ground.
Of course you did.
Of course you did. What else could go wrong? I mean, literally uncovering Roman artifacts. Now, I forget the details of how it played out. I think either it was deep enough that they wouldn't be disturbed, or it wasn't of enough historical interest to need anything doing with it. So in any case, I think it created a small delay, but nothing dramatic. But I just remember the phone call where David rang me and said, we're doing some digging, we found some bones, we've had to stop for a bit. And he's very northern and deadpan, and so I could never quite be sure if he's joking. And I was convinced for about 10 minutes that he was joking. Turns out he wasn't. So when you think you've listed out all the different random challenges you can come across with developments, there's an extra one for you.
Yeah, we'll add it to the checklist. So Rob, I suppose I better ask, what went right?
Well, what went right? The sales went right. We thought that it would be in a popular area, and indeed it was. So what we did was, of the 10, we sold 5 to investors through Property Hub Invest, so that was all fine. And then the other 5 we marketed locally, and the agent was very good. It was very popular, so we got those sold without much drama. I think 1 was sold to a local investor, and the others are all owner-occupiers. And then since then, the investors have started renting their flats out, and the rental demand has been off the charts. So it's good to know that we got it right in the first place. The research was correct. There was demand there, and we built a quality product that's renting really strongly. So that's a real positive. And what else went right? The build in general went really well. All the challenges that I've talked about are mostly around the admin side, around third parties like the council and utility providers. The build itself, considering we were managing everything down to individual labourers, not much went wrong. There wasn't even a lot of delay. The delay was around the admin side as well. So when you consider all the things that can go wrong with a build, and there are a lot of them, I think it's worth recognising that, on the whole, a lot went right.
So, Rob, thank you for sharing that. I know that it probably wasn't that easy, but at least easier than getting it built. Let's get into the lessons, the takeaways here, not just for yourself, but for anybody contemplating doing this themselves in the future. You know, a lot of property investors aspire to get to this point, to be able to do their own development. So let's get those lessons out. You know, let's make sure your pain was worthwhile and others can benefit from it.
Yeah, I think the main lesson for both of us was that we underestimated the project management side of it. everything that needs to be done, as well as the actual build. So when you don't have experience in this kind of thing, it's so easy to get held up by not knowing that you need a certain certificate to be issued for something before somebody else can come in and do something else. Or you know that you need something and it seems really simple, but you don't realize that it takes several weeks to turn that around. So of the 1,000 things that need to be done during a project, it's really hard to know which are the ones that need to be done before the next one? Where do you really have to push because it's going to slow things down if it doesn't get done? There's loads of that. And even though David's been involved with hundreds of sites, we're still coming across things like that. So if you're going into a project without any experience at all, that's where you can get really tripped up. Even if you have a contractor who's doing a lot of the work, all the project management side of things is really tough. Linked to that, there's so much potential for delays as well. So you need to ask the council to close off a road, but they won't do it for 2 weeks. Or somebody needs to come and sign something off, but they're on holiday, so another week goes by. You don't need one big thing to go wrong to end up getting delayed by a fairly significant amount overall. I thought that if everything basically went smoothly, then you'd get to the end being where you expect it to be. But even though there was no one single dramatic event that really caused a problem, all these small things just accumulate and just gradually nudge you further and further off track.
And the other thing that happens with all this stuff, Rob, is it nudges you further and further away from the profit you originally wanted. All these things add up. You know, time delays cost money, and costs can appear from different places no matter how well you plan.
Exactly that. That's what happened to us. There was no one area where we got it massively wrong. There was no huge unexpected cost, no disaster, but you end up spending money on hundreds of different things. So it's very easy to just end up with lots of small overspends that cumulatively add up and end up wiping out your profit. And that was a real lesson for me. It's impossible to run a project where nothing goes wrong and you get everything right. It can't be done. There are so many moving parts. There's always going to be things that don't pan out as you expect. And even though I'm not experienced, we had someone in David who's hugely experienced and he did an amazing job. He would have prevented 100 extra things going wrong that very easily could have done if someone less experienced had been there. But even with all of that, there were still all these little factors. So I think the lesson is that you need to have a lot of margin in it, because however careful you are, a lot of that margin is going to leak away in ways that you can't predict.
And Rob, your exit here was to a combination of investors and owner-occupiers, and that itself comes with different challenges and expectations.
Yeah, and the stress around the sales was quite something as well, because by that point it was done and we just wanted it to be finished. And yet, as you know, with sales, you think that you're going to complete, then a solicitor will suddenly out of the blue ask for something else, or the lender will suddenly throw up a bizarre objection that they'd never mentioned up to that point, and it just ends up dragging on and on. So there were a few very intense weeks trying to get these transactions through. Also, because we were late by this point, we had a couple of owner-occupiers who were really keen to move in and were putting a lot of pressure on us. We also had an investor whose mortgage offers were expiring, so they were in a rush. So it was all super duper stressful. And none of that is particularly surprising. You know that when you're transacting in property, it's going to be stressful and lots of weird, random things are going to happen that cause you delays or cause you aggravation. The thing that I hadn't fully appreciated up until I did this was how difficult buy-to-let mortgages are compared to residential. So our residential sales sailed through. There was no drama. The lenders didn't ask too many questions. We even did one through Help to Buy that didn't really add any complication. All fine. The buy-to-let mortgages, completely different story. The lenders were so much more demanding, asking so many more questions, and also being so much less organized, asking for things again that they'd already had, or suddenly raising queries out of the blue at the last minute when they could have done it weeks ago. Getting those sales through was so much harder. And I knew that lending was tougher for investors, but until dealing with both simultaneously, I didn't realize just how difficult it was.
Rob, thank you for sharing this. And it's really weird. People listening would probably expect we've talked about this multiple times over the last few months, but because we're so busy with our heads down in the day-to-day, we don't actually get to discuss these things. So I didn't know half of what you've been through. So I've really enjoyed that. Sorry, I know that comes across really mean. It's not meant to. It's just that the lessons you can draw from experiences like this are so valuable. But that's the thing. It's so rare for people to share journeys and experiences like this. So much of property investment is get rich quick and I'm a multi-millionaire multiple times over and do what I do and you'll be great. And that's just not property. Things do go wrong, whether you're doing a simple buy-to-let or a development. And often the more ambitious your plans, the bigger the problems. And that is a brutal truth that just doesn't get talked about enough.
That's exactly right. So the thing that I'd like people to take away from this is don't get involved in this kind of thing lightly. And that can apply in a couple of different ways. So if you are an extremely hands-on person, you're very handy, you're very well connected in the trades, that's great. That's an advantage. But there's still so much around that that you might lack experience in or might be outside your comfort zone. But the other side of this is if you're an investor who's got money or has got the project management experience and you're tempted to team up with someone for a project, don't take that lightly either. I was working with someone who was highly experienced, highly skilled, and who I trusted completely. If I hadn't been, I could have been in real trouble. And it terrifies me to think of the joint venture deals that people enter into off the back of meeting someone at a networking event once or something like that. It does happen. You hear about people doing it all the time, but it's so risky. There's so much that can go wrong that you've got to be very, very careful. And in general, I think even if you've got everything in your favour, you still have to be prepared for it to be quite a bumpy ride. And emotionally, it's quite difficult because the stakes are so high. The worst case is really pretty bad. There are so many occasions where, if we don't get this particular document, then the whole site's going to be unmortgageable. If building control come back and they don't like this, then it could cost another 100 grand to put it right. There are so many different points where even if something ends up being fine, you get a nervy couple of days where it might not. So emotionally, you need to be ready for that journey as well. It sounds like I'm saying never do development projects. That's absolutely not the case. But I am saying make sure you're ready, both in terms of your experience and the people you're working with, but being emotionally ready as well, making sure it's something you actually want to spend a year of your life doing.
So Rob, last question. Would you do it again?
Haha, I knew you were going to ask that. The answer is no, not in the role that I was in anyway. I think there are parts of the process that I enjoyed and where I really added value. So around, unsurprisingly, the marketing and getting the sales lined up and things like that. But there was also lots of chasing involved and trying to make sure that people had done certain things and trying to get certain documents, which is not a strength of mine and something that I found pretty stressful. So as part of a team where I could just play to my strengths, where there was a significant upside, yes. But it's not something I'm going to leap back into straight away, that's for sure.
Okay, so it's time for Hub Extra, where we like to bring you more. We do this on the podcast, where we bring you a lovely little resource every week. But we also do this via email every Friday. Everyone who's signed up on the Property Hub website gets the Hub Extra email on a Friday. And it is awesome. So much more there. So make sure you look out for that in your inbox. But this week, Rob, I'm a bit worried by the title. Does this mean you've given up on property after your experience? Because you're recommending a program called The Missing Crypto Queen from BBC. Is this a new direction?
No, not a new direction in terms of getting involved in cryptocurrency or indeed in running a massive scam, which is what the podcast is actually about. It's a really amazing 8-part podcast series from the BBC about a lady who launched a brand new cryptocurrency, which was going to be bigger than Bitcoin. It is going to revolutionize the world of finance. She pulled in billions and billions of euros of people putting money into this and then vanished. Completely disappeared. No one knows where she is. So the podcast is trying to track her down and try to uncover her story, but it's mainly about the scam itself and how she managed to pull it off and the psychology that was used to be able to get so much money off people. And I found it fascinating from that point of view. And some of the techniques that were used are very similar to some of the things that we talked about with Mike Winnett on recent episodes about the things that he's seen in industries like property and affiliate marketing, because it's all human psychology. It's all the same kind of tricks work, whatever it is that you're trying to promote. So fascinating from that point of view and just a really good story. So well worth checking out.
So a huge thanks to you, Mr. D, for sharing your experiences this week on the podcast. Let us know what you think. Do you feel sorry for Rob? Are there lessons that he should be picking up that he's not yet? He'd love to hear from you and critique. No, I'm sure most messages will be of support. But if you would like to get in touch and let us know what you think, well, you've got multiple ways of doing it. On the social networks, it's super simple, at Property Hub UK. We're on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And head over to the forum as well, propertyhub.net/forum. You can find a link to this episode there and you can give us your thoughts and input. So that's us for another week. We'll be back with Ask Rob and Rob on Tuesday, and we'll be back next Thursday with the Property Podcast. Hopefully not as painful, but just as informative. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.